My name's Matt, and I will be talking to Ofer Mayor about realities of the tech industry, from implementing agile methodologies to navigating uncertainty and leading successful startups.
Ofer, you are not only a leader, but you are still a hacker at heart. So this is what I read on LinkedIn, and when I enter your office, I already saw the intercom with the Face ID, so I thought this is the right place, and for sure you work here. And I'm wondering, do you still code, or maybe are the technologies that you're passionate about today?
So I don't code that much, but maybe just as background, I'm a security guy at nature, a hacker. So I was never a big developer, right? And maybe later we can dive a little bit into this notion of CTO as a dev leader, as a CTO, as a subject matter expert leader. So I've never been a great developer. I can code, of course, but I've never been a great developer. And these days I barely code, maybe a script here and there, but I'm still doing security, right? So I'm still working with my teams. We do incident response and investigation. So I still work with my teams. I ask questions. I want to understand what it is that we're investigating, what it is that we're doing, and dive into that. And, hacker at heart is just, it's just general, right? I a few years ago, I got bored about not doing anything technical enough. I was still at my previous job at a big corporate, so I built a smart home on my own. Just, learned all the electricity stuff, everything. It's a state of mind. It's about having the notion of wanting to know how things work, being able to break them apart and build them from scratch.
Nice. So for sure you are a good, engineer. So you have the engineering mindset. And you mentioned the topic about the CTO as a, as a developer and as a kind of like a guide. So maybe you could elaborate on that?
Sure. I think this is something that is very challenging, especially for in the founders community. The term CTO means a million different things, right? And in a lot of companies, you get two or three people founding the company. One is the CEO, one is the CTO, right? And then what is a CTO? But I think if you zoom out a little bit, there's a huge difference in expectations from a CTO in a company that sells something to end users who are not technologists, right? If I'm the CTO of Salesforce, for that matter, right? Then the users are salespeople. Then you are expected to be the leader of how this is being built, what is being built, how it's implemented. Whereas if you're a CTO of a company that sells to technologists, usually the CTO is expected to be a subject matter on what the thing is doing. It's a little bit closer to product than to engineering. And I think in cyber, it's very common, right? You'll see CTOs that are predominantly cyber experts and more often than not great developers. And in those cases, by the way, if you're a founder and you're listening to that, if you're a CTO cyber expert, you're probably not the best developer. You should bring a VP R&D very early on to the team.
When you tackle this topic, I'm thinking about the current team structure at the Mitiga. So maybe could you elaborate, how do you structure it?
Right. So today I have in Mitiga engineering reporting to me and product reporting to me, and then IT. But really, it signifies exactly that. I'm not a great development leader. And so I brought early on a really great R&D leader. And of course, he reports to me, but I let him do his job and I trust him because he knows how to run a dev team much better than I do. And then I have product management reporting to me where, again, even though they know how to do, the day-to-day of product probably better than me, but there, because of my cyber nature, I get involved more on the details because that's what I bring to the table, the subject matter expertise in cyber, understanding what our customers need, because I understand that business.
So I think you already answered my next question, because I was wondering, who is your partner in crime on a daily basis, of whom you talk the most, right?
So I always look at it, that there are two types of partner in crime, right? I have my team here, right? So my product leadership and R&D leadership. But the other partner in crime is sales. And that's another thing about CTO. And again, there are a lot of facets of being a CTO. But I think for a startup company, especially a tech company, the CTO is a very outbound role, right? as a subject matter expertise, I'm not only guiding the product, but I'm also helping communicate what it is that we do. And so I personally work very closely with sales and even more so marketing, you know, thought leadership, blogs, you know, connecting with research and all those pieces so that I can help, you know, build the message and send the message of what we do at Mitiga, because we're solving a problem, something new. We need to do market education, and it's something where having subject matter expertise is valuable, not just marketing.
You mentioned that the security or cybersecurity domain is a bit different. So I would say, like, you are not a typical CTO, because a CTO sometimes we relate to the code, and you said you don't code so much. It's more about the security and the cybersecurity. So maybe could you explain that domain a bit?
Right. So if you look at what a cybersecurity expert is, and again, cybersecurity is a huge realm as well. But cybersecurity is, first of all, about breadth. So you need to understand how systems are working generally. You need to have some understanding of networking and application and operating system and now, of course, cloud and virtual machines and all that stuff. And you need to understand how all of this is working. In development, and again, you know, I would say ideally every technologist has a really good understanding of how everything is working. But practically in development, a lot of times your focus is really about the code and what the code runs on. And understanding how that works, you don't necessarily need to understand the network. But as a security expert, you do. And then you need to understand and have a mindset of how to break things and how things can get broken, right? And that's a different expertise. And so, of course, I can code, because understanding code is part of understanding security. But I think there's a huge difference between knowing how to code and how to break code versus knowing how to build software. Building software is about, you know, scale. It's about architecture. It's about things that not just about writing code, but writing the right code. And in these areas, I'm not an expert. Again, I've never really built a software. I think my longest development project was a month.
So you are better in breaking the things.
Oh, breaking, great. So in the beginning of my career, my first company was a penetration testing red teaming company. We broke everything, hacked everywhere legally, of course. But that's fun, and it requires a certain skill set, because it's about looking at a system, looking at how it behaves, and being able to quote unquote reverse engineer in your brain how it works, and from that figure, oh, it's doing that. Well, if it's doing that, I'd probably give it this input, and that will make it do something completely unplanned.
Based on that, and maybe outside of that a bit, so what is your biggest challenge in your role?
My biggest challenge is bringing all of this together, right? We have here a great engineering team. Not all of them are security people, of course. We have a great product team. We have research. We need to bring all of this together, and we're creating something that is completely new in the market. That's there are two approaches to building a startup. One of them is, let's look at something that's a very immediate problem and it's great, but then you're going to see 20 different startups in that realm and then you're beating them against all of them. Or you can say, I'm identifying the next big problem, and then you start early. You don't have that much competition, but you have a lot of market education to do, right? I tend, and again, judging at my past, I tend to historically go for the latter. I like to do new things. And the challenge is bringing it all together. So, you know, everybody has ideas on what it is we need to build. And because it's new, even the customers don't always know exactly what they want to ask from us. So, you know, as I'm working with product, is trying to bridge that, okay, this is what the customers think they want or say they want. Some of it is true. Some of it, you know, is still a gap on what they will need a year from now. What it is we believe the market needs and where it goes and what will help sales, because at the end of the day, if you don't sell, then what's the point, right? And how to tie all this together into a coherent roadmap. And then the other challenge, and that's always funny, it's like sales and customers, especially as customers that talk to us are on this exploration mode, right? They're figuring out this new market. So they want you know, give me a 6 or 12 months or 2 years roadmap. It's like, I can't give you a 2 years roadmap because this is an emerging market and we're, you know, we're changing course every quarter or even more frequent than that. And so, you know, I know where I want to go, but if you look at what I talked about 6 months ago and where we want to go, and if you look at my next quarter's roadmap, they're not completely aligned, right? We've changed a lot.
It's a really dynamic environment. So, and I always like to ask leaders about their strong opinions about something regarding the software delivery or product delivery, that maybe you have something like this offer that you don't agree with, something that everybody say this should work this way.
I don't know if I don't agree about what people are saying, but maybe about what people are doing. I think, so we've touched on that, right? This dynamicism and agility. Everybody's talking about agile, right? For a decade now or more. A lot of the work I've done. So in my previous role, I was in AppSec. So I've done a lot of work around security, testing into agile development life cycles and so on. So everybody's talking about agile. Everybody's moved to sprints and it's great. But then when you really dive into it, in most organizations, there's a lot of planning ahead for these agile sprints. And so you see companies with a solid 6 month road plan divided into a lot of 2 week sprints. Great. But it's still a very solid 6 month roadmap. And so I think, and I think this is because most people struggle with uncertainty. Interesting. I'll take a side note. I was just listening to this podcast and they were talking about uncertainty, and they said they did this research and they put people, connected them to electrodes and told them, when I push the button, you're going to get electrocuted. And then just the other group, they said, when I push the button, there's 50% chance you're going to get electrocuted. And the second group, that was 50%, they were way more stressed than the first group. The first group was just, okay, it's coming. Second group, I don't know, is it coming? Is it not coming? So people like certainty. And agile is the opposite of that, right? True agile. And what happens is people say, we want to be agile, but then they go and say, well, but I need a roadmap. And, you know, you get sales saying, but the customers want to know what's coming next quarter and they need to make commitments. And again, we understand that, of course. But even in the development side, they're like, oh, I'm writing this. I don't know what I'm going to do next. Like, people don't feel comfortable with uncertainty. And so even though they talk about agile, they don't always practice it the way you would want it to.
I understand it really well. I think the similar thing is with the responsibility. Like, everybody wants to be a manager. Everybody wants to have a lot of responsibility. But, you know, when they get it, sometimes they are lost. And this is something that they didn't want, in fact, right? So I don't know if you have serious that.
I think, you know, this another discussion. But the higher up the hierarchy you are, you need to be able to deal with more uncertainty, right? And that's part of being a manager. Part of being a manager is saying, well, you know what? Maybe this quarter we missed the goals, but we know how to settle that and understand that because, you know, the markets change or things are moving. We did something else instead, and that's fine. But if you're not ready for that, it's going to be hard for you to go there. And so I think, going back to the agile, I think another part, again, I'm a big believer, and people say in agile, you know, build it, then throw it, right? It's fine to build and throw. It's better than building around things. It's very hard for people to throw things, right? And so they're like, no, so let's add this and this and this so we get to something that will work really well. It's like, yeah, but then if we throw it, it's a lot of throwing. Let's just build something small. If it doesn't work, throw it, but it's hard for people. And so, you know, I'm preaching that all the time. I think we're doing a pretty good job here. I wouldn't say perfect, but a pretty good job here in being agile. And again, we have to because, as I said, emerging technology and a lot of course corrections in perfecting the product market fit. But I think that's a big challenge.
And how about the topic of AI? You have the Copilot, you have all those generative AI, you have ChatGPT, all that kind of stuff. I'm just wondering, what is your opinion about that? Do you play with this a bit, or do you see like a bright future?
Resonating, yes. So I played with it, the day it came out. To be honest, I was so blown away when I first saw ChatGPT. Again, not just me, but it took me back to 94. I'm old. When I first saw the web, right? In 94, I remember that day. I just graduated from high school, and I went to see something in the college I was going to, and there was a computer there, and it had Netscape 099 on it, beta. And I saw it, and it was like, wow, there's Yahoo there, right? It was mind-blowing. And I don't think I've felt that mind-blown since that time until I opened ChatGPT. So AI, of course, is amazing technology. We're exploring AI here in Mitiga. We're already using, of course, you know, the easy stuff, marketing stuff gets supported a lot by ChatGPT. We're doing some Copilot. I think the challenge with using AI that way is that people want it to do their job for them, whereas it's just another tool, right? And so we've had this internal evaluation of Copilot, and somebody from the team came back to me and said, you know, it's a great tool that can make a great developer even better, but can get a mediocre developer to be very, very bad. And that's true for every use of AI, right? Because it makes mistakes. We know that, you know, it hallucinates stuff. It does things. And if you let AI, you know, if you let Copilot write code for you that you don't understand, then how will you ever debug that, right? But at the same time, it's great. And so the other thing that's very exciting is about how do we take this technology and embed it into our platform, our technology? How do we use it not just for us, but for our customers? And so we actually had a hackathon last week, internal hackathon on using AI as part of the Mitiga platform. Four different projects. Each group managed to get something working in 2 days, which is amazing. I mean, the power of this, and again, none of this is production ready, of course, but a working demo in 2 days, you know, team of 7-8 people of something that's really, you look at it and say, wow, I think it's, you know, there's a big bright future here.
That's so cool. I agree. I see it the same as you said. I see it as a humanoid, you know, from Amazon humanoid when you are in a warehouse and you could like handle like big boxes with usage of the robot on yourself. It's like using ChatGPT, but you need to understand like how to move, right?
Yes. And I think people get confused, you know, like with everything new. I remember when ChatGPT was just out, the first time I used it to write a blog post. And you know, basically I put my bullets in and I asked it to do some of the writing, but proofread, stuff like that. And somebody noted in one of my you know, technical forums, somebody noted, well, you didn't give it credit. It's like, why do I need to give it credit? I said, well, it or he or whatever wrote some of the blog. I said, I also didn't give my word spell checker credit. It's a tool, right? And as long as you remember that it's a tool, as long as you remember that it's not, you know, it's not really doing something that you don't mean for it to do, then it's fine.
And how about the recession? I'm just wondering, do you feel the recession in your industry or around the big tech? Do you tackle it in some way?
Of course, I think everybody tackles the recession. It manifests in pretty much every possible way. There's, you know, slow decision process with prospects. There's budget constraints. I'm happy to say that we haven't lost any renewals due to that for now, but I can imagine that happens too. Cybersecurity is doing fairly well in the recession. Statistics are showing that most organizations haven't cut security budgets. They maybe haven't increased them as they have before, but at least haven't cut them because cybersecurity is still a problem. I don't know if you're following the MGM story from the last few days.
But, no. Could you tell?
Yes, of course, public. It's not something. MGM, you know, the big hotel chain, Vegas, has a major breach starting in the cloud. So very much aligned in what we do. So obviously I'm following closely. Combination of Okta and Azure breach. Then they went into their on-prem. And they're basically not functioning for a week now. I've just heard from friends who are in Vegas, they do check-in with paper, not in computers. Their entire computer system is down. Their restaurants are having a hard time charging people for their meals. Like, the whole thing is a mess. They're trying to recover. And so, you know, cyber attacks are not going anywhere. And so the cybersecurity industry is, I wouldn't say it's proof to the recession. It's not suffering from the recession as much. But also, and that may sound counterintuitive, but it's harder to find good people during this time. And this is something people are, oh, but there's so many layoffs and it's easier to find people and not so many companies are looking. But the reality is, and I've seen that in 2008 and 2000 as well, when there is recession, the good people stop looking for job replacements. They stay put. And there's a lot of layoffs, but in most cases, and again, I'm generalizing, and I apologize if I'm hurting anybody specific, but generally companies would not fire their top performers because it's all about efficiency. And so you get a lot of CVs of people. Some of them are good, but they're not usually the top performers. And what we're looking for now are top performers. And so it's harder to find them in the recession.
Yeah, I fully agree. It's the same in Poland. So like the number of CVs we are getting, it tripled. But like the thing, the paradox is like if you want a great people, like really senior or medium grade people, they are not looking for a job. They don't want it to change it because the market is so volatile and they could lose their job, so they are afraid. Yeah, and it's still hard, right?
You go to a new place, right? There's always risk that it won't work out. You're not going to like your boss. Something in the company, you misread it from the interview. So there's risk. So if you're in a good place and you're appreciated there, you're not going to leave and take a risk. Because then if that risk materializes, who knows how will you find your next job, right? And so good people are not moving. It was the same in 2008, I remember it. It's even more so now. At the same time, there are still a lot of companies that have money and are looking for good talent. So, I see that we've just hired two new team leaders. It took us almost half a year to find them. Then we found, crazy story, we signed them both on the same day. But it was a long process to find them because, again, we've interviewed a lot of people and it was really, really difficult to find this talent. And then, you know, once in a while when we already find somebody that we really like, that they have 5-6 offers and they don't always pick you.
I want to ask you for an advice that you could offer any others like tech leaders regarding the product delivery on your side, because you said you are pretty much agile. You try to do things fast because the environment is really dynamic. So maybe you have some lessons learned that you could share with other leaders. What worked for you? What is helpful for you? What do you do to do it so fast?
So first of all, it's about, you know, it's a cultural thing, right? So it's about knowing how to build something that's not full and that doesn't cover all the edge cases to start with. It's about having a culture where people are efficient. So not too much bureaucracy and red tape. And also having a culture that's not a blame culture. Because a blame culture puts people at a defensive point and then they have to think in every move they do, like, oh, what could go wrong, right? So it's being very collaborative. We're very open. You can even see this from our office. Everything is transparent. Even, you know, some people are in rooms and not in open space because there are a lot on the phone, but all the walls are still completely transparent because I think it's super important. There are no secrets. We work together. And also, I know this may not sound like a very popular opinion these days, but minimize work from home.
Oh, okay. Why so? Why do you think so?
Collaboration works better when people are in the same room or the same office. One, there's the, let's call it the random collaboration, right? There's official collaboration. Okay, we need to work on this project. Let's have a meeting, right? And we have a meeting and work. But there's random collaboration. You're sitting at your desk. You suddenly have a problem. You turn your head to the guy next to you. It's like, oh, do you know how to do that? And then somebody from the desk behind you says, oh, of course I know. It's like this, right? And then you talk at lunch about a problem and you hear things. I hear things in the office, right? I'm big management, so I don't always know all the details. But then I'm here so I can hear things. The other thing is, as much as we try and as much as we turn on cameras, things over digital media don't always have enough body language to contextualize them. So somebody could say something, somebody else could maybe criticize that or offer another perspective, and it may sound as criticism. Things generally escalate into arguments or, bad feelings much worse over digital media versus, like, Slack is worse than Zoom. Slack is worse than Zoom, and Zoom is worse than face-to-face.
Yeah.
When you're all in the same room, it diffuses very quickly. And so, you know, we are hybrid, but we work at least 3 days a week from the office. I encourage people to come more. I come between 4 and 5 days a week to the office. I think being in the office is really important for collaboration and for moving quickly as a team so people know what's going on. Because otherwise, you need to build a lot of processes for updates and knowing what's going on, and that slows you down.
One more question regarding, I'm trying always to find like the biggest lessons learned for you. I mean, it doesn't have to be about the product delivery, but as a leader, so you had this like aha moment, okay, so you do it this way, right? So how do you build the company? How do you scale? You know, something that is the biggest lessons learned you have in your mind.
I will say one thing. I think at you know, early stage and even, you know, late early stage, right? We're post A, we're 60 people, still early stage. I think it's super important to focus when bringing people, not just on what they know and their experience, but on two very important mindsets, right? One of them is on the technical side, it's people who care about what they do from a technical perspective and care to understand it. So when I do a technical interview, I never ask knowledge questions. I don't care what you know. Granted, I have more people in the interview process, but I don't care what you know. The one thing I care about is that whatever you worked in, you understand. So whenever I do a technical interview, I'm just going to say, well, tell me about your latest, biggest project. And then you're going to tell me something, and I'm going to start drowning with questions up until the point where the other side doesn't know the answer. And it's just to assess where that is, right? And a great candidate, it would take me a lot of time to get there. A lot of times, unfortunately, more often than not, you talk to people, you know, they've been developers for 15 years. You ask 2-3 questions, and then you discover they don't understand what they're doing. They know what they're doing, but they don't understand it. And so for me, in a position like a startup where it's constantly moving and changes, people have to understand what they're doing. And then the other side of that, and it usually goes together, it's people that have, you know, a passionate mindset about work. If work for them is a 9-to-5, you know, get the paycheck thing, it's not for a startup, right? You want people that want to come to work for a startup because it's really interesting for them and they're passionate about it. Usually, by the way, those people also understand what they did because that's their passion. I'm a big about passionate work generally. So, and then the other thing I would say to founders in generally is find a community. So I'm in tons of communities, founders community, CTO community, cyber community, like every type of thing I do, I have a community for it. If it's a WhatsApp group or a Facebook or Telegram or whatever, meetups, find a community, because at the end of the day, 90% of the problems you're dealing with, everybody else is dealing with. And being in a community lets you share ideas, ask questions, and also get you through, you know, the emotional stress of some of these challenges. And so I'm a big believer in communities, much more than, you know, a book or a conference. Communities of like-minded people who tackle problems like yours that you can talk to, share ideas with, ask questions. It's invaluable.
I like conference, but only on the backstage talks, you know? I'm learning the most from the backstage talks.
But that's because backstage talks are the community.
Yeah.
Right? And again, I'm not against conferences. I go to a lot of conferences. But conferences are a very, you know, it's a one-time thing, right? Okay, you go to this conference, you hear about of lectures. But when you have a community, like, I really like WhatsApp communities because I'm multitasker and chat is easy for me. So I can be in a meeting now with my leadership And then something come up, like, oh, how do others do it? And while we're doing this, I'm asking questions. And somebody, you know, it's a community of hundreds of people, somebody's going to answer that in 5 minutes. And so, you know, it's better than GPT.
Man, I do the same. I think it's like entrepreneurship kind of laziness. So you just don't want to reinvent the wheel, but you just ask people about their opinions. And I do the same. I have like three people that I really care and I know that they are better than me. And I'm always asking about their opinion before I make any, like, if this is important, let's say.
Yeah, I think this is, you touched on a very important topic, which is, you know, as a founder of a startup, you're already inventing something and you should focus your energy in the invention in that perspective. So if you're innovating on a new product category, probably focus on that. Don't innovate on R&D and sales and marketing, right? If you're innovating on a business model, that's also great, but then, you know, don't innovate that much on tech necessarily. It's hard to invent five things at the same time because it's hard for the market to receive it. It's hard for you to do it. And so, you know, we do enterprise software for cybersecurity. There are textbooks about how to do sales and marketing there, right? Okay, we need to do it right. We need to adapt it to our specific things, but we don't need to invent the model.
So that's really clever. Thanks for those tips. And I have the last but not least questions. I just wanted to ask you about the maybe some recommendation for the podcast, books, or maybe the communities, because you are a big fan, that have been influential for you.
I'm now very focused on a podcast called The Huberman Lab.
Oh, yeah.
It's not about tech. It's about, you know, life. It's about health. It's about mind. I find it to be amazing, and they touch everything. So the latest episode, or one before, is an interview with Mark Andreessen from Andreessen Horowitz, which is really mind-blowing, interesting, and like, I sort of know most of the things they say, right? I'm an entrepreneur, but he puts it in such precise wording and perspective that I'm enjoying every bit of it. I'm in the minute. I do have to warn the listeners. Those are very long episodes, 2 to 4 hours each. But it is right now my favorite podcast.
Nice. You are not the first one who mentioned the Huberman. So I really like it too. So Ofer, thanks for this talk. It was super interesting, super insightful. Thanks for that.
Thank you for being here and making all the way to Israel.
Follow Matt on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Better Tech Leadership newsletter.